Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For years and years, the history of East meets West was largely told by the West in tales of high seas and romance and derring do, Shogun, Noble House, Taipan. But the world's global now. Tables are turned. Indian novelist Amitav Ghosh is now telling the story of the immense opium trade with China. This hour on Point, Amitav Ghosh, River of Smoke and the Original Great Drug Trade. Best-selling author Amitav Ghosh's new book, River of Smoke, is the second of his Ibis trilogy. The first book, Sea of Poppies, was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize and was named Best Book of the Year by the Washington Post, San Francisco Chronicle, Chicago Tribune, The Economist. It was set in India's poppy fields. Now we're in old China with mountains of opium. Amitav Ghosh divides his time between Brooklyn, Goa, and Calcutta. He joins us today from New York. Amitav Ghosh, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's just wonderful following this trilogy. We learned so much about India, the Raj, its origins, and the economics of those tough poppy fields all up and down the Ganges and more in your first book. We've got so much to look at here, Amitav, but just set us in time. What's going on historically? What's the moment that we're at here? Where's the opium trade stand? We'll dive into the relationships, the intimacies, the moral issues here, and they are huge, but just set us in time and place.
Well, this book opens October 1838. You'll remember Sea of Poppies ended in like September 1838, and
yes,
this one starts in October 1838. Mm-hmm. This is a very sort of critical moment in Asian history and indeed in world history. Because this was the period sort of leading up to the First Opium War, which was really a sort of formative event in the history of modern China. But what's happened here is that, you know, in the late 18th century, from the mid-18th century onwards, the West faced this incredible sort of balance of trade problem with China, much as it does today. That is, they were buying enormous quantities of Chinese exports, but the Chinese didn't really want any Western products because, you know, they had everything they needed, and they felt that they could produce anything that they needed better and more cheaply in China.
What were they buying from the Chinese, Amitav?
Well, tea was the major thing that they mm-hmm. were buying from China. And, you know, one sort of forgets actually how large a trade the tea trade was. Because, you know, through most of the 18th century and well into the 19th century, the revenues on tea accounted for one-tenth of the entire revenues of Britain.
Wow.
You know, I mean,
wow,
that's an enormous wow. sum. It's about as much as they get from the financial sector today, you know, so
okay.
you can imagine.
Yeah.
What a vast sum of money that is.
And all the Chinese would accept in return was silver, silver, I guess. That worked just about anywhere. And when they brought it, one more thing, which you're focused on.
Yes. What happened is that opium is a very ancient medicinal substance, and people have grown it throughout Asia, throughout Europe, in the Middle East, everywhere, you know, because people have always needed opium as an anesthetic and so on. So there was a sort of small demand for Indian opium in China in the mid-18th century. And the British, when they faced this enormous balance of trade problem, they decided that the way to solve it was by increasing the opium exports to China. So they set about it in actually quite a well-thought-out way. They started sending, you know, larger and larger shipments of opium to China. They expanded the acreage of poppies in India. And in a period of like 30 or 40 years, they expanded the trade by, you know, 500-600%.
What was the Chinese posture toward this trade? What impact was it having in China? How was the Chinese government responding?
Well, the remarkable thing actually is that the Chinese response to the inflow of opium was quite exemplary in some ways, you know. I mean, they were the first society to face mass addiction, you know. And early in the 18th century, they did a study of it, and they realized that it was really dangerous to have so many addicts, and they banned it. And but it kept coming in. It was essentially a smuggling trade. It was illegal completely. Mm-hmm. But in the late 18th century, they realized that it was actually destroying their society. And so then they, you know, they redoubled their efforts. They banned it. You know, they imposed an even stricter ban on it. But basically, the British and American merchants managed to find their way around it. You know, they positioned some ships offshore where they knew that, you know, they were out of reach of the Chinese Navy.
Ships full of opium.
Ships full of opium, mm-hmm. yes. And then they, you know, they colluded with local Chinese traders and local Chinese smugglers. And they managed to have it, you know, sent into China in enormous quantities.
There's so much wonderful detail I want to get into here. But one of the things that I enjoy most about this is that you're sort of turning. This period has produced all kinds of books over the years. James Clavell, you know, loved his, and back in the day when it was Taipan and Noble House and all the rest, and people remember Shogun, that sort of attitude. But here you come at it from an entirely different angle, and it's not some swashbuckling Western sea captain who's at the heart of your tale, but I wish you'd introduce us to your protagonist. He has a very different kind of perspective and feel for what's going on here. Introduce us, if you would.
Certainly. The principal character in this book is a man called Behram Modi, and he belongs to a very small but very distinctive community in India. They're called Parsis. They're mm-hmm. Zoroastrians. Mm-hmm. They were originally refugees from Iran. They settled in India, you know, very early in the first millennium. And they're an extraordinarily enterprising community. To this day, they remain pioneers in India in many, many fields, including literature, science, mm-hmm. business, and everything. So Behram belongs to this community, which they were pioneering traders. And they were, you know, one set of traders who got very much involved in the export business between India and China. So Behram comes to China, you know, he started going there in the 1830s, and mm-hmm. As the book opens in 1838, he's on his way there with the largest shipment of opium he's ever succeeded in putting together.
And he's headed, we'll talk more about him, it's a fascinating story, he's headed into this foreign enclave, this isolated enclave where foreigners in Canton are permitted to pursue this trade. I wonder if you could read us a little description of this river enclave there in Canton. This is all the way back in 1838 or so. Could you read something for us there, Amitabh?
Certainly, certainly. And so at last to the foreign enclave, or Fanky Town, as I have already learned to call it. It is the farthest extremity of the city, just beyond the citadel's southwestern gate. In appearance, Fanky Town is not at all as you might expect. Indeed, it is so different from what I had envisioned that it fair took my breath away. I had imagined the factories would be prettily primped with a few celestial touches, perhaps a few curling eaves or pagoda-like spires, like those that so beguiled the eye in Chinese paintings. But if you could see the factories for yourself, Pugli dear, I warrant they would remind you rather of pictures of places that are very far away, Vermeer's Amsterdam, or even Chinnery's Calcutta. You would see a row of buildings with columns, capitals, pilasters, tall windows, and tiled roofs. Some have colonnaded verandas with the same khas-khas screens you see in India. If you half-close your eyes, you could think yourself to be on the Strand in Calcutta, looking at the bank shawls and daftars of the big English trading houses. The colors are quite different, though, brighter and more varied. From a distance, the factories look like stripes of paint against the gray walls of the citadel. The British factory is the largest of the 13. It has a chapel with a clock tower, and its bell keeps time for all of Fanky Town. It also has a garden in front and an enormous flagpole. Some of the other factories have flags flying before them too, the Dutch, the Danish, the French, and the American. These flags are larger than any I've ever seen, and the poles are immensely tall. They look like gigantic lances plunged into the soil of China, and they rise high above the factory roofs, as if to make sure that they are visible to the mandarins within the city walls.
Amitabh Ghosh reading there from River of Smoke, his new depiction, and it is a remarkable depiction in its intimacy and more of the time nearly 200 years ago when Western traders and his Parsi Indian trader were moving massive quantities of opium into China. You make the moral dilemma very, very clear. We'll come to that. But it also, you really focus on the cultural interplay, the depth of it, the intimacy of it. I mean, you're drawing something beautiful alongside something very ugly here out for us to look at, Amitabh.
Yes, that's absolutely true, Tom. I mean, I think, you know, in writing this book, one of the great, one of the most wonderful things about writing this book was really the discovery of Canton, you know. I mean, it's a place that we hear about, but, you know, just to go there and explore it and discover it. It's, of course, the modern city of Guangzhou, mm-hmm. and it's a very ancient city, really. It's a very, very ancient city, as old as Rome, some would say. And it's a marvelously varied city with, you know, it's a very beautiful city with a wonderful old buildings and so on. But what was really fascinating to me about Guangzhou was the depth of its history and the way in which it's been a sort of hinge between East and West for millennia, you know. So much has come to the world through this one city in China. All the porcelain, all the tea, the silk. It was the only city that was allowed to trade with the Western world for centuries. So, in fact, I mean, almost everything that we've received from China, and that's to say, you know, the world has received so much from China, but all of it has come through this one city.
Amitav Ghosh joins us from New York. And, you know, Amitav, I spent a lot of time in this part of the world, worked for an editor at the South China Morning Post, who was a great collector of chinery, the painter of Chinese scenes, often for Western audiences, that you've got kind of in the middle of your book. And there's one point where a son of his, Robin, as you tell it, is there. He's been doing business in Canton, a painter himself. He's just sold a painting to Mr. Chan, a Chinese client. He's there in Canton or on its outskirts. He's been paid. And to seal the deal, Mr. Chan invites Robin Chinnery to share a pipe of opium with us. Robin here a little nervously agrees, but it gives us a sense of what it was that dragged so many Chinese into this drug. Could you read for us?
Certainly. Within an instant, or so it seemed, I was floating away into the canopy of wisteria. I've heard it said that opium is unpredictable in its effects. Although it makes most people torpid and silent, there are also some who become uncharacteristically loquacious under its influence. The truth of this was immediately demonstrated to me, for even as my own tongue grew heavy, Mr. Chan seemed to become more communicative. I do not know exactly how it happened, but suddenly he was talking to me about his journey to England 3 decades before. I listened to Mr. Chan with my eyes closed, but not a word escaped me, except that after a while it was as if I were not listening at all, but actually seeing his narrative unfold before my eyes. Such are the miraculous powers of the drug, that it was as if I had become a 15-year-old gardener called Ah Fei. There I was on the deck of an East India Company ship, a lone Chinese boy traveling westwards through the oceans towards England.
Amitav Ghosh reading from his new book, River of Smoke. Remind us of some of the American fortunes with roots in the American opium trade in China.
Well, that was actually one of the most astonishing things about writing this book. Just discovering the sort of depth of the American connection with the opium trade, in fact. Well, one of the biggest opium traders in Canton in the early 19th century was a man called Andrew Delano. And he was Franklin Delano Roosevelt's grandfather.
Okay.
And that's where the family money came from. There are many Coolidges involved in the opium trade.
As in Calvin Coolidge, the president?
I can't say definitively mm-hmm. whether there's a connection, but I think there is actually between that family and the Coolidge and Calvin Coolidge's family. Washington Irving, the great American writer, his nephews were involved in the opium trade, and he himself used to make little speculations in opium. There he was sitting in New York writing away and at the same time speculating in opium far away in Canton.
How did people think about it in those days? I mean, you've got the traders there blustering and wrapping themselves in free trade, kind of in a way that I'd never made the connection. I mean, this is free trade. Of course, they'd wrap themselves in their nation's flag when the Chinese tried to push them out. But free trade was at the heart of the justification for the opium trade in those days?
Absolutely. I mean, the whole idea behind it was free trade. And this is what so much amazes me nowadays when we hear all this talk about, you know, free trade. I mean, there's such a mirroring between that period and this period, you know. But we hear all this talk about free trade. And, you know, in fact, the opium trade was conducted exactly under the aegis of this idea of free trade. But there again, you see such a peculiar sort of double think, you know, even within the Western traders and the Western institutions. That were pushing this trade, because there you have the British, they're waging war against China in the name of free trade, but they actually produce opium under a strict monopoly of the East India Company in India.
Yes, yeah.
So, I mean, you know, it's just one of these bizarre things. I mean, and we see that actually happening even today. You know, on the one hand, we have, you know, Western governments talking about free trade, but we know that the Western governments were instrumental in setting up certain cartels. Like mining cartels.
And you've got all of this, of course, in your book, River of Smoke, witnessed from the perspective of your Parsi trader, Indian trader from the west coast of India. At one point, Bahram Modi is, you've got him smiling to himself, listening to the arguments. So marvelously simple. This is in English that are going on there. Marvelously simple, yet irrefutable. And he says, this Indian trader, who's also in the opium trade, but he's saying, thinking to himself, really, there was no language like English for turning lies into legalisms. You won't read that I think, Taipan. Jonathan, calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Thanks, Jonathan. You're on the air with Amitabh Ghosh.
Hi, Mr. Ghosh, Tom. Thanks very much. My father, the late Jack Downs, wrote the great nonfiction book about this subject, the American community in Canton prior to the First Opium War. The Golden Ghetto.
Sure, yes, absolutely.
It's in your library, and so, of course, I cut my teeth on this growing up, and so I'm really looking forward to reading your at least the first two books of your trilogy. And it's I guess one of the great China traders you haven't mentioned yet would be the Forbeses, right? From
another
great Boston family, the ancestors, well, not directly of our current senator. John Forbes Kerry.
But were they opium traders? I don't know, Jonathan. Were they?
Well,
I know they were China traders.
John Murray Forbes was certainly an opium trader, absolutely, with Russell and Company.
My goodness. Hmm.
And so it was interesting to me that John Forbes Kerry was holding hearings in the Senate on the drugs trade.
And here's Amitabh Ghosh. I'm quoting him here, Jonathan, in his book. He's talking about the Chinese who dealt with the foreign traders, including opium traders. And he writes, among their oldest and most loyal customers were the vessels of a Boston-based firm, Russell and Company. Through them, their family had acquired a large American clientele. It sounds larger by the minute. What are you thinking as you hear this depiction, Jonathan, with your father so deep in thinking about this largely isolated, but incredibly sort of intrusive foreign and American presence there on the shores of the Pearl River in Canton?
Well, you know, it's interesting to me that the difference in their behavior in Canton versus in the United States or back in England or in India, for that matter. You know, these are the fine families of Boston. These fortunes built on drug money, or prior to that, fur money and silver money. Well, in any case, so it's interesting also to think that these same families invested Chinese money in America at that time. The great Hong merchant, what was it, Hauqua?
Yes.
Who invested in the New York Central eventually with John Murray Forbes, and a lot of this opium money went on to build the railroads in the U.S. And to think of this very small community of tea and opium traders trading opium from Turkey and eventually India into a closed China, and then bringing the money back to build American infrastructure at the beginning of the 19th century.
It's
fascinating.
Yeah, it is.
I'm looking forward to reading your book, Mr. Ghosh. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling, Jonathan. Yeah. It's so nice to hear from you, because your father's book is, of course, the definitive book, and it's a wonderful book, and it was very, very helpful for me. And, well, I didn't know about John Forbes Kerry, but it makes sense. But actually, so many important American families were connected with this trade. So many important American institutions were really, financced by this trade, educational institutions.
There's such an intimate tangle, and to think of Chinese money coming back and maybe ending up in the railroads in the United States is kind of incredible. What was life like for these foreign traders in the Golden Ghetto, as Jack Downs, Jonathan's father, put it? What was it like there, Amitav? You looked very closely at letters and newspapers and all kinds of reports from that time. What have you found? How do you see it?
Well, it was quite amazing, actually, because you see, one of the rules for their being there was that they weren't allowed to take their families. So no Western women were allowed into this golden ghetto.
Mm-hmm.
So it was all men from many different parts of the world. There were lots of Armenians, there were Indians, Parsis, there were Turks, there were people from many different countries in Europe. So it's this incredibly sort of cosmopolitan group. And these people are amongst the richest men in the world at that point, you know, enormously wealthy tycoons. But there they are. They have they don't have any women there, but they have all these servants. And so they eat incredibly well. They have bands. I mean, they bring in their ships' bands, and often they dance. That's what they do in the evenings. You know, they have all these parties, they have these regattas.
China traders, opium traders, very, very wealthy men dancing with one another there, sending the money back to the mansions at home. And many of them, and including your Indian Parsi trader, also, of course, with loves here in Canton, invisible to their wives at home.
Yes, there they were. They were living for 6 months, 8 months of the year away from their wives and their families. And yes, many of them had had Chinese mistresses, and frequented Chinese flower boats, as they were called in those days. But there's another aspect to it too, you know, which is that when you read the letters and when you read between the lines of the mm-hmm. letters and the journals that were written in Canton and around Canton, there's a certain campiness, you know. I mean, you can see that, many of these men were confirmed old bachelors in a very sort of old-fashioned way, and they had deep sort of relationships with each other.
Are you talking homosexuality or just a different era's kind of friendship and intimacy?
You can't really speak of it as homosexuality as such, because it wasn't, that whole sort of range of behaviors and mm-hmm. ideas arose later. But certainly, mm-hmm. I think these men had very intimate relationships with each other. I mean, it's perfectly clear from their letters and journals, and indeed from the letters and journals that the women write about them in Macau, mm-hmm. you know.
many sources, very active sources. Amitav Ghosh dips deeply into them, and with a lot of Asian perspective that's quite revealing and wonderful in his new book, River of Smoke. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Carolyn's calling from Boston. Hi, Carolyn. Thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm so excited. I've been waiting all morning for this interview because I read The Sea of Poppies, and I have to say, it is such a beautiful, lyrical book, and I'm so glad that the second one is out. So thank you so much, Mr. Ghosh. That's wonderful. If there were details about relationships, Mr. Ghosh would not shy away from them. The first book is so exciting, and the personal relationship details are mm-hmm. just great. But my point, actually, besides the literary beauty of his writing, of your writing, sir, is that the hypocrisy that he captured so well in the first book, and I'm looking forward to seeing elaborated on in the second book, is so alive for the Chinese today. They know about this forced sale of drugs. They know about the hypocrisy about what is free trade, what is not free trade. And for Chinese today, this historical lesson that Mr. Ghosh puts into a fictional framework is critical, absolutely critical, and we need to understand that as we look at how the Chinese deal with the West. So thank you for putting it into a way that we can all enjoy that very real and important lesson from history.
Carolyn, thank you so much. Amitav Ghosh, do you see this full awareness that Carolyn's attuned to through you, still in the Chinese view of the world today?
Well, thank you so much for those comments, Caroline. I mean, it's wonderful that you had that response to Sea of Puppies, and it's wonderful for me to hear about it. Yes, you know, the opium trade is forgotten in the West. In India, it's completely forgotten, even though perhaps 90% of the opium that was sent to China came from India over a period of about 150 years. In India, there's no mention of it. We are never taught about it. But it's the reality of what was happening in India in the 19th century. But in China, the memory of this, of the opium trade, is vividly alive. In Guangdong, the southern province around Canton, there are innumerable museums and memorials to the opium trade. And it's exactly as Caroline said. I mean, you know, there's a profound hypocrisy around the world that surrounds this. But I would just take it a bit further and say, you know, that in some sense, we are all participants in this hypocrisy. The reality of today's world is that most of our institutions have had some connection with the opium trade at some point or the other. Four of the world's biggest ports today would not exist if not for opium. Hong Kong, Bombay, Singapore, Shanghai really came out of the opium trade, opium wars. So, you know, in some sense, opium was the foundation of the modern economy that we speak of today as the capitalist economy. So it's strange that this is never recognized.
And to Carolyn's point about your depiction of hypocrisy, there's a moment here where someone is asking one of the big traders, Mr. Burnham, do you see nothing monstrous in your own actions, that is, pushing opium into China? And you have him saying, "No, sir," answered Mr. Burnham coolly, "because it is not my hand that passes sentence upon those who choose the indulgence of opium. It is the work of another, invisible, omnipotent. It is the hand of freedom, of the market, of the spirit of liberty itself, which is none other than the breath of God." I'd like to see the Mexican drug cartels trying that argument out on Congress or the DEA.
You know, I didn't make up this stuff. I mean, that's the extraordinary thing. When you read what was actually said around the opium trade and the opium wars, it actually beggars the imagination. This was exactly the kind of thing that was said. There was this constant sort of equation between opium, freedom, and God. Because many of these merchants were, you know, fervent evangelicals. They were missionaries, really, you know. Mm. We have innumerable descriptions of them, you know, selling opium from one side of the ship and distributing Bibles from the other side. There are these journal entries, you know. Someone saying, you know, "I was so busy selling opium this morning that I didn't have time to read the Bible."
We'll come to more of that. Amitav Ghosh, please stand by. The book is River of Smoke. It takes us into early 19th century southern China, Canton, the opium trade. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Amitav Ghosh. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about the original great drug trade, Western traders and more, pushing opium, lots of opium, into China in the early 19th century. Amitav Ghosh is with us. International best-selling author. He's in the middle of a trilogy of books about this trade. It's the whole era of the high seas, the China trade, and all the rest, but told from an Asian perspective, started in India with the cultivation of the poppies in Sea of Poppies. Now he's at River of Smoke. It takes us to the southern coast of China, Canton, 1838, right into the heart of the actual trade, pushing it into China and China's resistance at that time. Let's go right to Evansville, Indiana, and Lynn. Lynn, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to say, you know, this is Mr. Gosh's perspective is so refreshing to the West, I think. I am originally from China, first generation here. But I think, well, growing up in China, like what he said in his books. There's a lot of movies being made and literature and museums that's been, you know, still exist in there and talk about this. And it's not forgotten. You know, but I just want to thank him for bringing this up, you know, for this kind of an absence in the history and all the lessons that we could learn. And I would, you know, I haven't read the book yet, but I'm going to. It sounds really, really interesting. I wanted to ask Mr. Gosh if he actually mentioned about about Hu Men Xiao Yan. It's one of the, you know, historical event where it was huge. It was dramatized in a way about, you know, all of burning the opium.
Yes.
And it was gathered in Canton, and everybody, you know, there was a huge crowd gathering and trying to see that event. I just want to see, you know, if he mentioned anything in his book.
He absolutely does. But Lynn, thank you. Amitav Ghosh.
Well, thank you very much for that question, Lynn. Yes, I have described the destruction of the opium at Hu Men by Commissioner Lynn Zizou, and that's a significant part of the book, actually. Yes, and yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, in China, these memories are very vividly alive. And, you know, sometimes, just the other day, I opened the paper and there was, I think it was President Obama or some other major figure sort of saying, well, the Chinese have to learn about about responsibilities in global trade and so on. And I was thinking to myself, how must this read from the perspective of someone who's really familiar with this history? You know, and what responsibility in global trade has meant for China.
We will no doubt come to know as China's global presence grows. Lynn, I really appreciate your call. And one more here. East Lansing, Michigan. Mark is calling. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I must challenge both of you fellows. I'm listening very frequently, but I hadn't heard of these books before. And on the historical point, I'd ask you to please expand. Give us some information. I'm sure that a majority of the listenership have not read your previous book, but we really need some history on the literal fact, the cause of the triangle of trade that brought opium and the development of clipper ships. What the fact being that Britain had become so in love with tea that they became so indebted to India, they had to have come up with some commodity to refresh the treasury. It is a fact that the British treasury was in danger of being completely emptied.
Mark, we'll look at that, I promise you, but I'm just curious, does that, to your mind, justify them saying, oh, we need something, let's sell them opium?
Well, no, just that it is a fact. If there was no law against opium at that time, there was no law against opium use in the United States at that time.
Mark, let us pick it up. Amitav Ghosh, your response.
Yes, he's right. There was no law in the U.S. or in England, but there were laws in China. See, that's the problem, really. I mean, you know, suppose I were to say today, or suppose the Mexican drug cartels were to say that, you know, there's no law against cocaine, let's say in Ecuador or something. Would that make it okay to bring, those drugs into the U.S.? I mean, the most basic issue there really was one of sovereignty, really. I mean, you know, the Chinese understood very, very well what opium was doing to them, and they outlawed it repeatedly. And in the end, you know, they had to go to war to keep opium out.
You've got a letter from the commissioner, Commissioner Lin. I think you quoted the letter he wrote to Queen Victoria. I don't know if you can find it expeditiously in your copy of the book there, Amitav. I don't know if you know what page it's on. But it does start out saying that he's saying to her that he says, I'm told that in your own country, that is England, Britain, opium smoking is forbidden under severe penalties. And was the Chinese commissioner wrong about that? Illegal in China, but not in the U.K.?
See, the thing about it is, again, there's a sort of a gray area there. opium was not actually illegal in China or in India, but the situation was that the British tried very hard to discourage it. So, in fact, opium was not freely traded in England. It was not freely available in England. So, you know, it's not actually the case that it was, widely circulated inside England. And, you know, the British were fairly aware of the extraordinary power that this drug had and that, you know, what it could do.
I've got I see a little bit of it here where he says, he's writing to Queen Victoria, no less, and says, so long as you do not take it yourselves but continue to make it and tempt the people of China to buy it, you'll be showing yourselves careful of your own lives but careless of the lives of other people, indifferent in your greed for gain to the harm you do to others. Such conduct is repugnant to human feeling and at variance with the way of heaven. This is quite a high-level international communication here, Amitabh.
Yes, absolutely. The letter actually never reached Queen Victoria. And of course, Queen Victoria herself, like many English women, took opium in the form of laudanum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was very, very common at that time, you know, for men and women to take laudanum. So, but it is a very powerful letter, you know, Commissioner Lin's letter, and you'll find many versions of it on the net.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, it's a very powerful sort of cry of conscience. You know, he's appealing to them to stop this because, you know, they can see in China that their institutions are being eroded. I mean, that society is being eroded by this trade.
Mm-hmm. Michael in Waltham, Massachusetts. Michael, thanks for calling. You're on with Amitabh Ghosh.
Hi. When I was in Vietnam, I often went to Hong Kong, and I often promised myself I would come back after graduate school and go back and live in Hong Kong. And after I graduated from Harvard Business School, I did so. And when I was there, I met this wonderful woman, Victoria York, who was part of the family of the Jardines, who were the original people from England who caused the Opium War. They were the strongest trading company then. And when I lived in Hong Kong, which was in the 1970s, they were still the strongest.
Jardine Matheson, still no small force today.
Yes. Same family.
Yeah.
She was actually Lady Victoria York. And the Frasers were the other side of her family. Quite a remarkable outfit. I mean, they're all aristocrats now. And actually, I think on Victoria's side, they were aristocrats for a long time. I think her father was the Lord of Hardwick or something like that. Anyways, the Frasers were also long-time aristocrats. In fact, her uncle, Lord Lovett, formed the British commandos in World War II and led them in D-Day wearing, get this, how British, his favorite hunting jacket and his favorite hunting rifle. They were quite a family. And her aunt, Antonia Fraser, quite a wonderful writer, just published a recent book about her life with Harold Pinter.
Yes, I saw that book. I mean, you're entirely right, Michael. The footprints of that time still very, very visible, even alive in Hong Kong and beyond today. Amitabh, you must have seen this. I mean, I spent years in Hong Kong. This is not distant history. If you're there, it comes right to the fore in flesh and blood.
Absolutely. And what Michael said is absolutely true. The Jardines, especially William Jardine, was he was the brains behind the war, really. He planned it. He actually sort of went to England and told Lord Palmerston how to fight it.
The Chinese burn the opium and the British won't have it. And I assume this is where your trilogy is headed from reading in River of Smoke.
Well, I'm not sure where it's going yet. But what's very interesting about the Jardine fortune, though, is that it was basically founded in Bombay. William Jardine had this very close collaborator, a Bombay merchant called Sir Jamshedji Jijibhoy. And to this day, if you go to the Jardine Matheson headquarters in Hong Kong, you'll see that there's an enormous portrait of Sir Jamshedji Jijibhoy there.
I want to come back to your Indian West Coaster north of Bombay, Bahram Modi, in your book. And you have one of your characters at one point in here, looking at his kind of awkward situation. He's also a big opium trader here, but very much in the minority as an Indian trader. And they're talking about why he's been put in this position, why he's doing this. And one of your characters says he's not like Dent and Burnham. These are big British traders. He says, in other circumstances, he, and that is the Asian, the Indian protagonist of your book, in other circumstances, he would have been a pioneer, a genius even. It is his misfortune that he comes from a land where it is impossible, even for the very best men, to be true to themselves. And that is Hindustan or India. What do you mean there? And are you talking about a historical circumstance? Is it something that you see as now changed?
Well, what's interesting to me really about Behram Modi is that in some way he is a profoundly ethical man, you know. And in fact, many of these traders, as somebody pointed out earlier, one of the callers, many of these traders were incredibly generous philanthropic men. I mean, which is why so many of America's educational institutions, for example, were endowed with opium money. Many of these traders, when they were in India, were incredibly generous. They founded hospitals and schools and, you know, very important institutions. So they were by no means cynical men. They were extremely ethical men. And, you know, it's very clear also that many of the traders, Indian traders, who actually found themselves entering this trade were very reluctant to enter it. They didn't want to go into it. But this was the biggest engine of commerce available at that time. How could they stay away? And in fact, to this day, any important, every single important Indian company that dates back to the 19th century, in one way or the other, was founded because of the capital that came in through this trade, you know. Some of the companies which now are competing with American companies were really founded with money that, you know, came out of this trade.
You do have a letter, and I believe it's historical, from one American who was there to a Charles Eliot, where he writes about the impact of this trade. Not everyone was at all blind to the moral consequences of it. I wonder if you'd read from the top of that letter for us, Amitabh.
Certainly. this is written by Charles King, who's a historical character. He belonged to an American company which actually opposed the opium trade, and they still made money. So he was very active in trying to stop the opium trade.
The Oliphant Company, as I recall.
Oliphant, yes. From Brooklyn, in fact,
yep.
Yes. Mm-hmm. To Charles Eliot, Esquire. For nearly 40 years, British merchants, led on by the East India Company, have been driving a trade in violation of the highest laws and the best interests of the Chinese Empire. This course has been pushed so far as to derange its currency, to corrupt its officers, and ruin multitudes of its people. The traffic has become associated in the politics of the country with embarrassments and evil omens, in its penal code with the axe and the dungeon, in the breasts of men in private life with the wreck of property, virtue, honor, and happiness. All ranks from the emperor on the throne to the people of the humblest hamlets have felt its sting. To the fact of its descent to the lowest classes of society we are frequent witnesses, and the court gazettes are evidence that it has marked out victims for disgrace and ruin even among the imperial kindred.
Even into the imperial household. And he concludes that letter saying, already we're told the use of the drug is insinuating itself into the habits of a morbid portion of Western society. There's a little harbinger of things to come. And he warns, you know, to be careful of the reaction of temptation on the tempter. It's wonderful to have this from your perspective.
Yes, it's...
it's just great. We're not used to it. And it sort of lights it up in a whole new way. Is it liberating for you, or do you feel yourself a kind of man of the times in being able to be, you know, here you are, Indian-born and writing this for a great global audience and not with that old-fashioned, wasn't it grand, Western perspective?
You know, to look at this trade from an Indian perspective is deeply humbling. I mean, it's a kind of horrifying story, really. And it's a story, as I said, that, you know, we don't tell ourselves in India. So, in fact, I'm really not looking at it from the Western perspective, or really much more from the Eastern perspective, and what it means for India, especially in relation to China in the years ahead. But you're absolutely right. I mean, Charles King's, I was just in Brazil, you know, and wherever you go in South America, you can see that the drug violence is such an important aspect of the society. It's become so critical. And Charles King was really warning of this, you know, in 1838.
There's much more to the book. Let's just touch it for a moment. It's not all opium dens, that's for sure. There's a great thread through here on the botanical trade between China and the rest of the world and all the beautiful flowers out of China. Here's a list you've got. I'm amazed to think of all the flowers China has sent out into the world. And of course, it was a big deal finding them and getting them to the rest of the world. But listen to this list. Chrysanthemums, peonies, tiger lilies, wisteria, rhododendrons, azaleas, asters, gardenias, begonias, camellias, hydrangeas, primroses, heavenly bamboo, a juniper, a cypress, climbing tea roses, all that from, as you write, Amitabh Ghosh, this crowded, noisome, noisy, voluptuous place we call Canton and its nurseries. It's a very multidimensional depiction of what was then, and really a terrific one. I hope you'll come back once more when you figure out how to end this trilogy and take us on through the rest of the curve.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's been a great, great pleasure to talk to you.
Amitav Ghosh.
As always.
Oh, thank you, as always, for our part as well. Amitav Ghosh's new book is River of Smoke, the second in his Ibis trilogy. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can continue the conversation and get our podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Imada, Alex Kingsbury, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell. With help from John McConnell and Sarah Moad, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.